Okay, no. Wait, you can ask me afterwards. And they're, of course, due on Tuesday, just to remind you guys again. Okay, so today we're going to talk a little bit more about quantum computing. We did some simple algorithms on Tuesday. We're going to talk about some others today. And we're going to start off with Grover's algorithm, which is a search algorithm. So the idea is you have an unstructured database, so there's no sort of underlying structure which you could use to find the solution more quickly. And you want to find some special item in amongst this database of n items. And we assume that it's easy to recognize the solution, but difficult to find it. So although you wouldn't use this algorithm for something like factoring, that's an example of something where it's easy to recognize the solution, but difficult to find it. So if there's no structure to the problem, then classically we need order n queries, if there are n items in the database, to find the special item that you're looking for with a given probability. And that's just by randomly sampling the database to try and find the special item. But quantum mechanically, we can solve the same problem in order square root n queries. So we get a square root speed up. And the algorithm is probabilistic. So we're going to talk first about a special case where we just want to find something out of four items, and then we'll talk about the more general case. So let's suppose we have two qubits which can encode four different states, and we want to find the special item in amongst the four. So as usual, we start with, first of all, we start with some function, f of x, and we're looking for some item out of the possible four. So we say that f of x is equal to 1 if x is x0, the one we're looking for, and otherwise it's equal to 0. Okay. And then we start with a superposition state, as we've been doing in the past. So, say x. Like this. So again, we're considering the special case where there's just four items. And we have an auxiliary qubit 0. So as we've been doing before, we consider some sort of oracle where we can operate on the state, so, here we are. And this is exactly like we've been looking at in the Deutsch-Jones algorithm. So if we set the second qubit into a superposition instead, then again, as we've seen before, when we act on it with this unitary, we get a phase which depends on the value of f of x. So so far this is all as things we've discussed before. So now we don't need to worry about this qubit because it's just, there's no information in that anymore. So this is the state that we're interested in. And exactly one of the states, x, has picked up a minus one phase because there's exactly one for which f of x is equal to 1. And all the others just have a plus 1 in front of them. And now we want to convert that that it has a special phase into that it has a different amplitude so that we can make some measurement and find out what this x is. So the operator that we use to do that. Okay. We can write in this form. And the psi is just the equal superposition of all states. So first of all, we've been talking about unitary evolution. So we should show that this operator is unitary. So it is indeed unitary. And now what happens when we act on the superposition state with this? Well, in the case of three, oh, sorry, of four. Let's assume that let's assume that the article we're looking for is in the qubit 1, 0. And I'm picking that at random, so it could have been any, so it doesn't matter. So then I have a minus sign in front of the 1, 0 component. Now let's look at the matrix representation of the D. Well, this is what the state psi looks like. So the outer product just has an equal component in all states. So it should be four. So finally, the matrix representation of D So we can write D as a matrix in this way. And now finally, we can look at how it acts on the state of that form. So we just call this state alpha. I can write that as a column matrix as 1, 1, minus 1, 1. And if you multiply these out, so I have a half here. We can see that this is the state that we end up with. So finally, we can measure in the computational basis. So we just measure this 1 and 0. And that gives us where the item we were looking for was. Okay. So that's a simple case of just 4 items. And it's deterministic. So the final state is in the state we're looking for with certainty. And in general, for the n item case, it's probabilistic. But it still does pretty well. Okay, so now let's look at what happens in the n item case. So we start as before with our system in a superposition. Like this. And then when we act on it with the UF, we again pick up a phase on just the one that we're looking for. So I've disregarded the second qubit now. It's only important to give us the phase factor. And now we apply this D operator we talked about before. And to understand how this state evolves under these operators, it's useful to think of a geometric representation. And that is the following. So we started with our state in the superposition state side. And we can think of the state we're looking for, the x0 and the psi, as forming a two-dimensional subspace. So if this is the state x0, then the equal superposition of all states is somewhere in this plane. And at the start of the algorithm, this is the state that we prepared. And then at the next stage of the algorithm, the x0 picks up a minus 1, and all the other states stay the same. So that's equivalent to the x0 component goes to minus x0 here. So it gets reflected like that in the plane. So if this starts at an angle theta. So now let's look again at this. So that's some state perpendicular to x0. Okay. So it's the x0 and the psi that form some two-dimensional subspace. And there is a orthogonal vector in that subspace. So similarly, there's a vector orthogonal to psi in that subspace, which we can write as psi prime. So now our state is this state alpha down here. And how does this operator act on alpha? Well, it's useful to note that in this subspace, so this is just using the fact that in that subspace, psi and psi prime form a resolution of the identity. Okay, so alpha gets changed to this state. And what that means is the component of alpha along psi perp gets flipped to minus. So and that's equivalent to flipping about psi. Okay, so as before, here we showed that if x0 picks up a minus sign, it's equivalent to reflecting about x0 perp. And so this is exactly the same. The psi perpendicular part picks up a minus sign. And so that's equivalent to reflecting about psi. Okay. So if it wasn't minus theta, we've reflected about this. So this is a 2 theta. So let's now look at how the state has evolved overall. We started off with the equal superposition state. And we can write that in this form. Like that. Okay. Yes. Oh, I apologize. That's a perpendicular. Yeah. You mean just this sign here?
Yeah.
So it just means that vector is perpendicular to it. Sorry. So to correspond to the way that we've drawn a diagram there, this turns out to be sine theta x0. Plus cos theta x0 part. So when we apply the first step of the algorithm, the state gets transformed in this way. And then when we apply the next step, we have d times uf. Well, just geometrically, we can see that this is what happens to the state. And the algorithm continues to iterate these two steps so that the vector gets closer and closer to x0. So the way that we've drawn, that I've drawn it here, it's almost there already. But the idea is that theta is quite small to start off with. And then we keep iterating these two steps until it gets close enough to x0. And then when we measure, you have a very high probability of finding it in the state that you're looking for, the x0. So if we were to apply those steps again, so the next time we apply the oracle function, we again pick up the minus sign here. And then we apply the same d unitary again, and we get another 2 theta rotation. So these together, we call this g. So it's g squared. And this is the Grover iterator. So if we continue to do that, so if we iterate k times. Then this is what happens to the state. So if after k iterations we measure the state, what's the probability that we find it in the one we're looking for? Is that not clear? Yeah, sorry. Apologies. Yeah, sorry, that should be sorry. That's just a mistake, sorry. Yeah, probably. No, nothing like that. So here I've just used alpha to be UF times psi. So after the first step. But in this derivation, I've just used psi. So don't worry about it. So we keep iterating these unitaries until after k iterations we decide to measure. And this is the probability that we find the system in the state that we're really looking for. And we want that to be as close to one as possible. So we just choose 2k plus 1 times theta to be as close as possible to pi over 2. I apologize for my writing. Can you make that up? Ah, okay. That's not me. Okay. And we've seen that theta is defined as the overlap of the state we're looking for with the maximally, the equal superposition state. So we defined sine theta to be 1 over the square root of n. And if n is large, then we can say that theta is roughly equal to 1 over the square root of n. So we choose k to be equal to this. Which is order squared, but yeah. K is an integer, exactly. So you choose it to be as close as possible. So really, I mean, you take the closest integer to it. So you round down, or either way, round down, round up. It's pretty much the same. Just whatever the closest one is. And that's why it's probabilistic rather than deterministic. Because you can't always choose, this won't always be an integer. If that was an integer, then you could choose it so that the probability really was 1, and you could get it deterministically. So that's what happened in the first case we discussed, the simpler case of just 4. But in general, it won't be integer, so there'd be some error. But, okay. I'll go over here. So we've chosen k to be the closest integer to this. So that so that this is the case. But we can see that k is always so. So the difference between the integer value of k that we choose and the one that really would give pi over 2 is of order 1 over root n. Because if it wasn't, we could just choose the next k up or the next k down. So the error involved is bounded as well. So the probability of error so the probability that you make an error is just of order 1 over n. which is small as I get fit. So just to note that all we've done is use the standard function we've been talking about, UF. And then apply this operator D. And the D knows nothing about the x0. It's just some, it's independent of the x0. So this works quite generally. Okay. So we iterate these two operations to drive the state towards the one that we want to measure. Okay. Any questions? And so this is the first sort of more useful algorithm that we've talked about. We talked about the Deutsch-Jose one, which is more of just a demonstration that quantum algorithms can do more than classical ones. But this you might actually want to use to search. It has an obvious use. Okay. So we should talk a little bit about computational complexity. The complexity of a problem is, we talk about in terms of the resources needed to compute the solution. So, and quite broadly, we say that problems that can be solved in a time polynomial in the size of the input fall into a complexity class P. So the size of the input is in terms of the number of bits that it takes to store the input. And for example, something like something simple like addition is obviously in this class. So if you want to add to n bit numbers, all you have to do is store them and then just do XOR modulus addition on each of them. So that's only n operations. And so these are considered to be problems that can be solved efficiently. Things like addition, multiplication, and so on. And then the classical strong Church-Turing thesis states that a probabilistic Turing machine, which is a simple model of computation, can efficiently simulate any realistic model of computation. And what I mean by that is that with polynomial overhead. So for any given computer, we can simulate it on this very simple model of a computer with only polynomial overhead. And then that means that it doesn't change the class, the complexity class, when we go from talking to, when we go from talking about one particular computational model to a different one. So if something can be done in polynomial time on one computer, then it can on another model. So that is the classical one. But quantum computers cannot be efficiently simulated on a classical Turing machine, so on some simple model of classical computation. So that questions this thesis. And another important computational complexity class is NP, which means that the solution can be verified in polynomial time, but not necessarily found. So this is something like factorization, which is considered to be a difficult problem classically. It's not known if P is equal to NP. So there are problems for which we don't know any polynomial algorithms, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. It just means that we haven't found them yet. Maybe. So it's conjectured that they're not the same, but it's not proven. And then finally, you have NP complete problems, which are problems for which, if you could solve this problem in polynomial time, then you could solve any problem in NP in polynomial time. So if you could prove that such a problem could be solved on a classical computer in polynomial time, then you could prove that P was equal to NP, which is one of the biggest open questions in computer science. And NP complete problems are things like the traveling salesman, which means a salesman has to visit a number of cities on his route, and you're given the distances between the cities, and you have to compute the shortest route that he would take. And as the number of cities gets bigger, this gets much, much more difficult, much more complex, faster than a polynomial in the size of the input. So then there are other problems like factorization, which are not NP complete, but are said to be NP, or thought to be NP hard. So that means that we don't know any classical polynomial algorithms for them. And the reason I'm talking about this now is because Shor's algorithm is an algorithm for a quantum computer which can perform integer factorization in polynomial time. So there's an exponential speed up over anything that's known to be possible classically. So the algorithms we've talked about up to now, the Grover's algorithm gives a square root speed up, which is useful. But what got people excited about quantum computers was Shor's algorithm, which apparently gives does give an exponential speed up. But again, it's only that the best classical algorithm that we know is exponential in the input size. But that doesn't mean that there aren't more efficient ones. And as we talked about when we talked about cryptography, this is an important problem for classical cryptography because RSA, public key cryptography, which is used for lots of the security on the internet, depends on the difficulty of this problem of factorizing. yes.
A solution well enough to win that $1 million prize for the NP equaling P or not equaling P?
No. And the reason is that quantum computers give you a whole new complexity class, which is the problems that can be solved in polynomial time on a quantum computer. also, they're not believed to be able to solve NP complete problems in polynomial time. So it's not believed that everything in NP can be solved on a quantum computer. So there are certain things like factorization which can be, but that's not NP complete. Does that answer your question? Okay. And Shor's algorithm, again, is probabilistic. Okay, so I want you to talk a little bit about Shor's algorithm. And there's a classical part to Shor's algorithm, which I'm not going to talk about. And then there's a quantum part, which is what we'll talk a little bit about. The classical part shows that the problem of factoring a large number n can be reduced to the problem of finding the period of a periodic function. So for some randomly picked number A, we want to find the period R, so H to the R is equal to A mod n. And this is a classical result, and the best known classical algorithms use this as well. But the difficulty then is actually finding the period, so finding the R. And that's what Shor's algorithm helps with. So we're going to talk about the quantum part of it, which is finding the period of a periodic function. And the way we do this is, again, we start with a superposition state. And the idea, as we've seen before, is to try and use this superposition principle to compute many values of the function at the same time, and then try and find out some global property of the function by comparing those and using interference. So as before, we use an oracle function. So we start with a register of qubits that can take any one of a number of values from 0 to some large number q. And we put it in the superposition state. And then we apply this oracle function, which in the factorization case calculates a to the r mod n. And the result of computation is placed in some auxiliary register. So next, okay, so this function is periodic. So for a given value f of x0, there will be a number of qubits of the first register corresponding to that same value. So suppose now we measure the second register and we get the result f of x0. Well, then the first register collapses into this state. With some probability, so we normalize. So this is just for normalization. So now the register is in a superposition of all states with for which f of x gives the same value, f of x zero. And so that means that the x's can be written in this form, because if the function f is periodic with period r, where j is an integer. And yeah, it's just for normalization. So it's the probability that you got results f of x zero, just to ensure that this new state has norm 1. Okay, so let's assume, although in the general case it won't be true, just for demonstrating purposes, that Q divided by R is an integer number, so some number m. Well, then there'll be m terms in the sum. And the normalization will be the same, 1 over m. So now we have a superposition of a bunch of qubits which differ by r each time. So we have maybe 0r, 2r, 4r, and so on. And we want to somehow find out what this r is. Well, from your classical physics, you probably know about the Fourier transform. And in this algorithm, we use the quantum Fourier transform, which is the following. So the quantum Fourier transform takes some basis state x to a superposition of states. Introducing phases between the states. So we now act on this state with the quantum Fourier transform. Okay, and so we also have normalization here. So it's just 1 over square root of q. So this still acts on the whole space that runs from 0 to q minus 1. So finally, at the end of the algorithm, we get this state. And we can do a bit more factorizing with that. So the x0, y factor is common, so we can take that out. And the key point now is that we get interference between the different phases. So suppose Ry over Q is an integer, then this sum Well, this is just 1.
for each of them.
So that becomes M. And the idea is that for other values of y, all these phases cancel out. And the reason is the following. Okay, so we have the sum of each of it. And actually, so we said that Q over R was equal to an integer. So we have YJ over M here. And similarly, YJ over M here. And again, we can think of these in a geometrical way. So think of these as vectors. And that's just a sum of all these vectors. So if we start with the case where y is equal to 1, then we have a vector in the real and imaginary plane. So this is the vector for j equals to 1. This is the one for j equals to 2, j equals to 3, and so on. And you can see that when you put all those vectors end to end, because j goes from 0 to m, they'll go all the way around, and the phases will add up to 0. Okay. So now we have that this superposition only has terms for which Ry over Q is an integer, so we'll call it K. So finally, make a measurement in the computational basis. We measure Y, and we find out. So Y is equal to K times Q over R. And we're looking for R. So we can measure y, and we know what q is. So we get y over q, which is equal to some integer k over r. And then we just write the fraction as some y prime over q prime so that it can't be reduced anymore. And the denominator is your candidate for r. And then you check So it's a problem that's easy to check, difficult to find. So you can easily check your value of R to see whether A to the R really is equal to A mod N. And if that's not the case, then well, you can either try multiples of R, or you can run, sometimes you will need to run the algorithm again. And that's because here we've assumed a special case. So we assumed that Q divided by R was some integer value. But in general, that won't be the case. And when that's not the case, all these other terms don't go to zero exactly, but the term in the superposition, the terms in the superposition with the largest probabilities are the ones for which this is closest to being an integer value. So it's probabilistic in that way. Okay. And so we haven't talked about the complexity of all the intermediate steps, but the things like the quantum Fourier transform can be done efficiently. And what are the things to be used? The calculation of the function A to the R can also be done efficiently. Okay, any questions? So I just want to talk a little bit about some of the issues for quantum computing and quantum information in general and the open questions. So we've talked about unitary transformations all the time. So we start with some state, we can unitarily transform it to some superposition, and then depending on what information processing task we want to do, we can perform some unitary on that. But of course, as soon as you have an environment, your evolution is no longer unitary. And so the information that you're trying to process can get corrupted. And just a really simple example is that the first algorithm we talked about was the Deutsch algorithm. And at the end of the computation, the system was in one of these two orthogonal states, and then you could just measure and find out which one. Well, a very simple case of interaction with the environment, these could become some entangled state. So we want it to be there's some environment here. We want the environment to factor out. But that doesn't always happen, and sometimes you have interaction between the environment. We could get some correlations. Between the system that we're interested in and the environmental system. And then when we talked about that this is no longer a pure state in the system that we're interested in. So the qubit system that we're trying to measure is now some mixed state density matrix instead of this nice pure state that we were looking for. And in the worst case, let's suppose this becomes a maximally entangled state. So suppose psi 0 and psi 1 are orthogonal. Then we get rho is disproportional to the identity. And no matter what measurement we make on it, it has equal probability of giving different results. So that's just a very simple example of how entanglement with an external system can mess up your information processing and computation. Now, fault-tolerant computation is possible if the probability of error is below a certain level. And the way in which you do error correction is by introducing some redundancies into your system. So for example, classical codes, you would encode one bit into three physical bits, one logical bit into three physical bits. So we would have 0, 0, 0 instead of just 0. And if there's one bit flip, say there's an error which takes it to 0, 1, 0, you just do majority voting and say, well, there's two zeros, so I think that the value of the logical bit was supposed to be 0. And you can do analogous things in quantum systems. But then you need, so some codes take 3, some take 5, and some take 9 qubits to encode just one logical qubit. And given that the experimental state of the art is maybe 7 or 8 qubits, if you need up to 9 qubits to encode one qubit fault tolerantly, then it's a long way off what we're able to do right now. And finally, we're assuming that as everything scales up, the world still behaves quantum mechanically. But of course, we don't know for sure that this is the case, although most of us probably think that it is. But the worst thing that could happen is we keep trying to build quantum devices, and when we get to a certain scale, we realize that the world doesn't really behave quantum mechanically after all, and we find out some new physics. Ah, that was in the wrong place. I was looking for that earlier. So what we've talked about over the last couple of weeks is taking advantage of the laws of quantum mechanics to do some information processing tasks and some communication tasks that are really not possible classically. And this is in contrast to maybe trying to suppress quantum effects as processors get smaller. It makes more sense to really start trying to take advantage of them instead. So these are some of the protocols that we talked about: dense coding, teleportation, quantum key distribution, and in the last couple of days, some quantum algorithms. But of course, it's not possible to do everything faster with a quantum computer. And we mentioned earlier that it's believed that NP-complete problems cannot be solved efficiently on quantum computers. So it seems to give some improvement over what's possible classically, but we don't know how much. And again, this is all based on things that we don't even know about the classical case. So we don't know whether P is really equal to NP or not. There may even be more efficient classical algorithms that we just don't know about. And we've talked about using superpositions and parallelism, but you can't just input a superposition and calculate everything at once on the superposition. You need to be careful about how you use things like interference to try and get something useful out of your computation. So it is possible to use these effects to design algorithms which are more powerful, but it's not always obvious how to do so, and that's why there aren't very many quantum algorithms. And there are lots of open questions. What are the class of problems for which quantum computers can provide an advantage? So we've only, as I've said, we've talked about a few, and there are only a few examples. important to note that in principle, of course, a quantum computer can do anything a classical one can. You just simply use the zeros and ones as bits and don't use any of the superpositions that are possible. But what extra can a quantum computer do? Well, that's an open question. And what is it that makes a quantum computer more powerful? Well, it seems to be superpositions and entanglement seem to be important, but that's not the full story. There are certain schemes that use hardly any entanglement and can still show an improvement over what's possible classically. And further, it's also been shown that if you can produce entanglement, so you have things like C-NOT gates that we talked about, but you can't do all single qubit operations, then that's not universal for quantum computing either. So you need more than just entanglement. Entanglement isn't the full story. And is quantum computing scalable? So I've roughly, I think, put these into, the first one is really a computational complexity question. The second one is more of a theoretical physics sort of question. And the last one is the experimental physics work. So we talked at the start of the course that this is really an interdisciplinary field that brings together researchers from all different disciplines. And these are just some of the examples of things that we don't yet know. And so there's a couple more references, just that are good introductions for people who are not experts. So the first one gives a really good review, very comprehensive, of quantum cryptography and its development and all the experiments that have been done. And the second one is an introduction to quantum information processing and talks a bit about the different architectures and things that we didn't talk all that much about. And it's in contemporary physics, which is supposed to be at a sort of an advanced undergraduate level, so it tends to be quite readable. And then finally, from Scott Aronson's blog, an article about Shor's algorithm, which is supposed to be accessible to anyone off the street, and it's very well written. Okay, that's everything. It's been fun. feel free to drop by if you have any questions about the problem set. And again, it's due on Tuesday. Any questions?
Like, can we email too?
Because
dropping
by for people. Are you guys mostly from
Guelph? There's like two people from Waterloo here.
Ah.
Yeah.
What's on? Yeah, sure.
Okay,
yeah.
Probably
no problem.
Yep. Any other questions?
Yes.
Can you say again what are the schemes that use hardly any entanglement and still produce more powerful results than on a classical computer? And what are the quantum properties that they use?
Sure. Well, I can talk briefly. I can tell you what I know. Oh, there it is. So first of all, I should have mentioned that there is a paper that shows that for exponential speedup, you need entanglement that spreads throughout all the qubits during the computation. But you can get non-exponential speedup. And so there's this one scheme called the power of one qubit, where you just have one qubit that can be whatever, and then all the other wires. So they can all interact. This is some pure state qubit, and all the others are in a fully mixed state. And it turns out that there's some interesting things that you can do with that, which really do give you a speed of over one. So people have started looking at some other measures of correlations. There's something called Discord, which I can't explain exactly what it is off the top of my head. But try to take account of both maybe classical correlations and entanglement and what that meant. Okay, great. Happy Easter.